The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
A surge of federal agents deployed to American cities. Kansas City's mayor says the dilemma facing his people, he's seen all over the globe.
Whether you're in Johannesburg, South Africa, or Detroit, Michigan, the cultural challenges that continue to perpetuate inequality are there and in many ways unchallenged.
I'm Marco Werman. We also hear from Hong Kong today, a veteran pro-Beijing politician. She says democracy activists are misguided.
I feel sorry for them. All the problems that they face now are of their own doing.
Also, matchmaking in India and doll making for kids with disabilities.
You know, you can't ask for much more than to see a child really happy.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We've seen the images, agents without identifying insignia in unmarked vans pulling people off the streets of Portland, Oregon during protests. We later learned that these agents were part of a rapid deployment force from the Department of Homeland Security. Days later, President Trump made this announcement.
Today I'm announcing a surge of federal law enforcement into American communities plagued by violent crime. We'll work every single day to restore public safety, protect our nation's children, and bring violent perpetrators to justice.
This program, dubbed Operation Legend, will extend across multiple major American cities, including Kansas City, Missouri. Joining me now is Quentin Lucas. He's the mayor of Kansas City. Mayor Lucas, why are these federal agents armed, descending on your city?
Well, I think a big part of it is relating to violent crime investigations. At least that's what the claim is, that this is to solve unsolved murders. The program nationally is named after a four-year-old who was slain in Kansas City. And what I've said before is we will take investigative help for things like that. What we don't want are federal troops taking over policing in the streets. We don't want a lot of the community conflict you've seen in places like Portland. And we certainly don't want something that drives even further divisions in our city and our country.
We didn't hear it in that clip of Trump a moment ago, but what do you make of Trump's use of the word surge of federal law enforcement, a word that's been used to describe overwhelming the likes of the Taliban or ISIS?
You know, I do think that it starts to militarize our communities. It creates conflict that's unnecessary. If one is looking at the last several months in America, the protests aren't about tearing apart America. It's about making sure people have more recognition, more voice. And so that's why we want to make sure that that isn't what this operation or these types of operations become. It's incredibly frustrating to see the pain of our communities. And there's real pain in murders and lots of victims' families to see that pain being exploited for political purposes.
So as you said, Mr. Mayor, Operation Legend is named after four-year-old Legend Taliaferro, a four-year-old in your city killed by a stray bullet last month while asleep in bed. His mother, Sharon Powell, supports Trump's operation. On one hand, people are in the streets protesting police brutality on people of color. On the other hand, Sharon Powell, a black mother, is supporting the federal agents on your streets. How do you reconcile that?
Oh, I think I can reconcile it very well. She wants justice for her son. We all want justice for her son. We have 225 agents coming to Kansas City. Right now, we have 60 unsolved homicides this year. If instead of having them do arrest warrants and all types of other things, you just assigned one agent to each homicide, that might be a program that people say, okay, we understand and we get. And frankly, I would support that too. And I think certainly Legend's mother would. You know, the challenge is you get stuck in this world of either ors, because I agree and want justice for her son. But I also, and I think we all, want to make sure that it's responsible, that this isn't just a dragnet, and that this does not become the type of federal forces that we see that I think are escalating a situation in Portland.
Mayor Lucas, one of the reasons we wanted to speak with you was that you lived in South Africa as an exchange student, and you followed the news there ever since, I understand. There are similarities between the struggles blacks have faced there and here. What occurs to you about how both governments police their citizens?
I think it's the fact that the uniforms change. Sometimes the race of the officers change, but we continue to use some of the same tools and tactics. And unfortunately, you see a lot of the same results. There was a massacre in South Africa a few years ago at a mine, the Marikana massacre. And it was fascinating looking at the video because you didn't know if it was recorded in the 20-teens or in 1984. I mean, it's shocking how there was still just dozens of people massacred. I think when you look at our American policing experiment, you continue to see similar results. Homicides were very high in Kansas City when I was a boy 25 years ago. So why do we still have the exact same answers, right? Enforcement, these surges. I mean, actually, Attorney General Bill Barr is using this because it's what he did when he was Attorney General the last time in the first Bush administration. And I don't know why we don't actually think, well, if it was a problem then, and it didn't really actually solve it that quickly, then why is it that we're doing the same thing now? Perhaps there's something more substantive culturally that's the real challenge and concern. South Africa is so interesting because I actually think the story of South Africa is largely the story of a lot of American cities where you have a high black population there, a supermajority black population. But even though there is purported change, whether you're in Johannesburg, South Africa, or Detroit, Michigan, your wealthiest people aren't coming from the community of the majority, right? You're the cultural challenges that continue to perpetuate inequality are there and in many ways unchallenged. And we kind of shake our heads and wonder why there are so many problems when I think it's very obvious to us why.
So you see parallels also in the hits democracy in both places are taking because of these policing strategies.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the challenge right now and what I think a lot of people are talking about, and I say this as somebody who understands the need for policing. I'm not an abolished police person, but you do have to make sure, right, like any other vessel of government, that people feel like they can actually hold police accountable, right? People actually having the chance to have a voice, people actually being able to hold their government accountable, thus their police as well. That's vital. And I don't know why in America it takes so much to get us to a point where we can actually ask such questions.
Mayor Lucas, tomorrow will be 2 months since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. What do you make of the protests that have spread to your city and across the country since then? And where do you think they're headed?
You know, I don't know where they're headed, but I've said a few times, and I get some negative attacks for it, I say the revolution will not be televised.
Gil Scott-Heron.
Right, right. And the reason being, we saw a lot of passion in the streets, but the change is going to now continue at city council meetings, at commission meetings, with police departments, fundamentally changing laws. Those are the sorts of things that I think are going to be vital for us as we try to make change. And, you know, I think it's essential for America's future that we get it right.
Kansas City Mayor Quentin Lucas, thank you very much. Great to meet you. Great to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
Uber drivers across Europe have some demands. They want to know what data the company collects about them and exactly how it's used. So this week, they're taking the company and its algorithms to court. Here's the world's Lydia Emanuelidou.
James Farrer used to drive for Uber in London. Today, he's locked in a legal battle with the company.
Uber was holding a lot of data about me that I didn't have access to.
Uber collects all sorts of information about its drivers while they're on the job. That includes their location, when they're late for a pickup, what routes they take. Farrer says drivers don't have adequate access to that data and that they don't know how it's being used to make decisions that could impact their work. Here's an example he gave me from when he was still driving for Uber.
I went to Gatwick Airport, and in Gatwick Airport, you have to pick the passenger up inside a car park that you have to pay to enter.
So he gets to the designated pickup parking lot, and the person cancels their ride.
So now I have to leave the car park, and I have to pay £4 and I have no fare to offset it. So I wrote to Uber and asked them to credit me the £4.
And they did. But Farr says they also did something else. He claims that Uber, without him knowing at the time, attached an inappropriate behavior tag on his driver profile, which could only be accessed internally by Uber employees. Farr couldn't see it. He says he only found out about it because of a glitch on the Uber app, which revealed several other tags, including one for negative attitude. Uber declined to comment on this.
What I really want to know is, if you're attaching tags to my profile, how are you processing those tags? And what are the outcomes for me of that processing? Does it impact the quality and quantity of work I'm going to be offered by Uber?
Could it lower his driver rating or get him kicked off the platform entirely? To get answers, Farr and other members of the App Drivers and Couriers Union, the ADCU, are taking Uber to court. The ADCU is a union in the UK that represents people in the gig economy. Farr co-founded it after he stopped driving for Uber in 2016.
We have the right to understand how the Uber algorithmic sausage machine is processing our personal data and what kind of outcomes there are as a result of that.
Anton Ecker says Uber drivers have that right under European data privacy laws. Ecker is representing Farr and others in this case. This week, they filed a request to the Amsterdam District Court to order Uber to comply with the EU's General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR. Amsterdam is where Uber has its European headquarters and where the case will be decided.
Based on the GDPR, the drivers do have a right to be informed about data processing, to gain access to the data.
In a statement, Uber told the world that it already does this, that when a driver requests their data, Uber hands it over to them, with some exceptions, the company said. For example, they won't share requested data if doing so infringes on the rights of another person. Ecker, the lawyer, says Uber is overstating how transparent it's been and that the company needs to do more to disclose what information it's collecting.
And finally, very importantly, Uber must inform the drivers about the profiling and automated decision-making that goes on within the Uber driver app.
This court request comes at a critical week for Uber, as the company is making a last-ditch effort to reverse a major decision in another case that's made it all the way up to the UK's top court.
Defeat for Uber, victory for its drivers? Well, we'll see. In a landmark case in London, a tribunal ruled that Uber drivers are in fact workers, not self-employed contractors. It's important.
This was back in 2016. James Farr, the driver from earlier, was actually one of the people who initiated this case, arguing that drivers should be treated as workers and receive benefits like holiday and sick pay and a minimum wage. Uber, which argued that drivers are independent contractors, not employees, lost and has been appealing the decision since. The final word is now up to the UK's Supreme Court, which heard from both sides earlier this week. Experts say, taken together, these decisions could have huge implications, not just for Uber drivers, but for millions of gig workers all over Europe. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Back in the spring, Israel took action right away to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Kids stayed home from school for weeks, but then toward the end of the school year, a decision was made: reopen the schools. Parents and teachers were taken by surprise.
We did not feel like we had any adequate time to prepare for that in order to make sure that the school was appropriately equipped for that many students coming back in one go.
And things did not go well. The virus came back in a big way, spreading through dozens of Israeli schools. Once more, authorities sent the students home. Now they're preparing for classes to begin again in the fall and looking to avoid the mistakes of the spring. Getting ready to go back to school during a pandemic in Israel. We'll have that story for you on Monday. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. China has fired back in the new diplomatic war of consulates. Earlier this week, the Trump administration ordered the Chinese consulate in Houston to shut down. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called China's Houston consulate a hub of spying and intellectual property theft.
If we bend the knee now, our children's children may be at the mercy of the Chinese Communist Party, whose actions are the primary challenge today in the free world.
The World's Rebecca Cather is in Shanghai. Rebecca, China has now ordered the U.S. to close its consulate in Chengdu. What are Chinese authorities saying today about this decision?
Well, Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin, he gave a press conference today and explained China's decision. Basically, he was saying that the order to close the Chengdu consulate is a justified response. He blamed the state of China-U.S. relations on the U.S., and he also accused employees of the Chengdu consulate of acting inappropriately without giving more details. He closed with a line that's been repeated in the media and in social media posts. He said, diplomacy is about reciprocity.
So we saw people behind the Chinese consulate in Houston apparently burning documents. Did anything like that happen at the American consulate in Chengdu?
Well, that is the question that a lot of people had in China. China State Television actually put a live stream of the consulate on social media for more than 6 hours and 42.6 million views. But there was no sign of any burning of documents to be seen. It was actually a pretty boring live stream, actually.
Mm. So closing the U.S. consulate in Chengdu, what does it actually achieve for the Chinese? Did the foreign ministry spokesman admit that this is essentially a retaliatory move?
Well, yes, I think that's what he meant when he said diplomacy is about reciprocity. And I think people read it as the Chengdu consulate sort of has the same weight as the Houston consulate. The mission covers all of southwest China, including Tibet, but it doesn't actually have a huge business volume, so it would have less impact on the U.S. in China. Originally, people had thought, well, maybe they'll close down the Wuhan consulate, but actually that consulate is effectively closed already because staff were evacuated earlier this year.
So the U.S. has a number of consulates in China, along with Chengdu and Wuhan, and then there's the embassy in Beijing. Do they serve different roles aside from visa services?
Yes, they do. You'll see that, for example, Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, they have much more of a strong business side. There's more Americans in those areas. In Chengdu, there's less Americans there.
Hmm. You've been watching the news and editorials closely in China, Rebecca. Any clues as to what happens next in this diplomatic tit-for-tat?
Well, analysts in China are seeing this maybe differently than analysts in the U.S. I was reading in the Global Times newspaper, which is a hyper-nationalistic newspaper here. They were talking with analysts who were saying that this whole tit-for-tat is actually Trump's way of distracting from the pandemic, and that his choice of targeting the Houston consulate was actually trying to appeal to a Republican base. So the analysts were saying, oh, Trump wouldn't want to close another consulate because other consulates are in more democratic areas of the U.S., and that wouldn't achieve anything for him. But I think there's also a little anxiety about what happens next because, you just keep on going this road and it doesn't look good.
That anxiety, though, I mean, do the Chinese seem especially concerned about where this could lead? I mean, how high are nerves right now, or does this seem kind of familiar to them?
It's hard to say how high nerves are. I think people are paying a lot of attention to it, both on social media and even in Chengdu. People were just, milling around the consulate area, just sort of wanting to see what was going on. And people were saying that we're watching history. But I'm not sure how much anxiety there is for Chinese citizens who may not feel any impact. I think there's more anxiety on the parts of people who either have a connection to the U.S. through business, through family, or, American citizens here.
The World's Rebecca Cather speaking with us from Shanghai. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you.
One of the big sticking points in the U.S.-China relationship right now is, of course, Hong Kong and the political pressure it's getting from mainland China. Washington has long seen the Chinese territory as secure for business and democracy, but Beijing is cracking down on dissent and limiting democratic freedoms. Last week, Trump signed the Hong Kong Autonomy Act, an executive order that puts sanctions on people and groups involved in extinguishing Hong Kong's freedom. It was this action that prompted a sharp response from Regina Ip. She's a veteran Hong Kong politician and chairs the pro-Beijing New People's Party.
It's really quite, I won't say laughable, it's a serious matter, but it's really quite eyebrow-raising that a great country like the USA sees the enactment of a national security law in Hong Kong as something that constitutes a national emergency. That's what the order says. Don't you think that's bit of a really overstatement. What's he talking about? Little Hong Kong constituting a national security threat, emergency to USA? This is really mind-boggling. It's all politics. It's all anti-China politics.
That's Regina Ip, one of the guests on this week's podcast, The Economist Asks. Podcast host Anne McElvoy also asked Regina Ip about pro-democracy activists like Joshua Wong and Nathan Law. Ip, who, as I said, is pro-Beijing, was forceful in her discussion with McElvoy. Here's a bit of that exchange.
It's their choice. They have gone on the primrose path to self-destruction. You know, it's their choice to want to promote separatism from China. I feel sorry for them. All the problems that they face now are of their own doing. You know, in fact, they are too young. They are too young to make judgments on these fundamental issues. Why should they be involved in promoting separation from China? Why should they do that? I often wonder who's behind them.
You think they are being steered by other people? I mean, they seem, and we've had contact with them over the years, like many journalists, they seem like rather independent-minded people. Nathan Law is 27 years old. It would not be unusual to be involved in politics or about the fate of the place you live at 27, would it?
Well, Nathan has studied at Lingnan University, where they have an academic who has been writing about Hong Kong as a separate city state, you know, Hong Kong's future as a separate political entity. Of course, there have been influences on these young people.
I'm sorry, do you not believe that they're capable of making up their own minds, given that they've been in this movement for many years and they've grown up in it, if you like?
I'll be happy to debate them. Too bad I never had a chance. I don't think they have ever taken part in some really rational, informed debate about Hong Kong's future. I wonder to what extent they really understand the issues involved.
Regina Ip, a pro-Beijing politician in Hong Kong. She was speaking there with Anne McElvoy, host of the podcast The Economist Asks. Every morning, the producers, reporters, and editors here at The World, we're all discussing and debating the most important stories that we need to cover. Want a seat at the table? Subscribe to our daily newsletter, Top of the World. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. For nearly a century, the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul served as a museum, a symbol of goodwill for Christians and Muslims. But Turkey's president saw his dream come true today. The museum was reopened as a mosque.
So this is a message about religious dominance and hegemony, and President Erdogan of Turkey has been very straightforward about this.
Why that's controversial these days in Turkey, ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. Maybe it's popped up in your Netflix suggestions, a new show called Indian Matchmaking. As the name suggests, it follows a marriage matchmaker who sets up men and women in India, and also Indians living outside of India. As The World's Rupa Shenoy reports, it's meant to be a lighthearted reality show, but it is stirring up controversy.
Indian Matchmaking has all the trappings of reality shows you've seen before. But of course, there's a twist.
I'm Seema Taparia. I'm Mumbai's top matchmaker.
It follows Seema Taparia as she flies around the world to meet with clients and their families.
Hi.
Come on in.
Hi.
She asks them what they're looking for.
So what is your expectation for your life partner?
Somebody who's got ambition, has passion when it comes to their line of work. That's just funny.
Seema takes down each client's so-called bio data, like their height and level of education, and adds it to the list she keeps in a three-ring binder she calls her database.
I study my database of all the clients and go for a good fit.
She sets two clients up, and they go on an awkward date.
Well, here we are. So.
It's all a modern-day version of an old-school tradition where, basically, parents lead the process of choosing a mate for their child. Many older couples in the show recall how their families set them up and how they met maybe once or twice before marriage.
It was arranged marriage. We met through India Abroad, the Indian newspaper.
We just met once, we walked, and I just liked his sense of humor. He made me feel comfortable, and that was it.
It works. We've seen where it works. Yeah.
But it didn't work for the director of Indian Matchmaking, Smriti Mundra. A decade ago, her anxious mom tried to find her a husband.
That was like kind of a strange time in my life because I was in this experiment with my mother where she just sort of took over my dating life.
That's when Smriti met Seema Taparia, the matchmaker.
The first thing she ever said to me was the line she says in the show.
In India nowadays, marriages are breaking like biscuits.
It was like distressing for her because she was trying at that time to figure out how to keep up with new ideas about marriage and partnership and all of that.
Smriti was intrigued. She pitched a film about Seema's work to a production company.
And I was told at that time that, oh, the show will only work if like she matchmakes what they called at the time Americans, which means white people. That was the implication.
So Smriti put it aside until a year ago when she pitched it again to Netflix. The company's trying to expand globally and is especially interested in the South Asian market.
And they were like immediately like, yes, that could be a show.
The intent, Smriti says, was to make the show for an Indian audience.
And it was a conscious choice to not explain everything because we weren't making the show for the white gaze, so to speak.
There's been intense discussion online and among Indian families and friends since the show debuted a week ago. One big issue people point out is the overt preference for a fair skin tone. Indian Canadian Ashani Nath wrote a review of the show for the South Asian site Juggernaut.
In the show, Seema Taparia frequently will refer to people being, you know, quote unquote, good matches because they're fair, they're tall, and they come from a good family.
The boy's good, he's fair, he's tall. And they want tall, they want fair, they want from a good family. He's fair and good looking.
But at the same time, there wasn't a critique of that. There wasn't a participant in the show who spoke in criticism of that. And I think that was a missed opportunity.
Ashani says there's also no discussion of the role of caste, the hereditary class system based on Hinduism. Some Indian parents still want their children to marry within their caste. Reconciling those old cultural beliefs with the current search for a life partner can be difficult for young Indian adults who were raised to think differently. Indian matchmaking shows some of the pressure Indian parents exert, like with Akshay, a shy young man in Mumbai whose mother lectures him repeatedly about finding a wife.
You and Papa decide. Then me and Papa will finalize. Final decision is mine, no? Good. Thank you.
There are also examples of how terrifyingly blunt some Indian elders can be.
I've had massive insecurity issues. People would come and tell me that you're never going to find anybody because you have to lose some weight.
The matchmaking portrayed in the show leaves out non-Hindus and LGBTQ people. Reviewer Ashani Nath says that's part of why she's always resisted her family's attempts to matchmake her.
I don't think arranged marriage is bad necessarily. It's just that some of the things that it normalizes and the people that it disadvantages are not okay, especially in this moment of combating anti-blackness and thinking about who in our society is systemically disadvantaged. It is extremely important to be critical about these institutions within our own communities.
Indian matchmaking director Smriti Mundra says she recognizes that. As an independent producer, she struggled for years to get financing for projects focused on social justice issues until this Netflix show happened.
As the only South Asian person on the key creative team, I had to represent everything, you know, and think about everything. And of course, like, that's tough and you're going to miss things and you're going to, you know, get a few things wrong.
Smriti says they didn't want to sanitize the show. They wanted to reveal everything about matchmaking, good and bad.
I knew more people were going to watch this and have access to this than anything else I've ever made. And I wanted it to start conversations. You know, I wanted it. I wanted to kick the hornet's nest.
Smriti never took to the matchmaking tradition herself. She married a Brazilian Irishman she met in grad school. And the character she most identifies with in the show is Aparna, a Texas lawyer who's willing to try matchmaking, but also wants to preserve her independence and ambition. Matchmaker Seema tells her,
we cannot be greedy. I want this, this, this. It cannot be a tailor-made. You have to adjust and little compromise.
And Aparna says,
there's nothing about me that I think I need to change or evolve or grow into to be a better partner for someone else.
And I think that's like an interesting tension, right? I think that's like the tension we all face, like even when we're on dating apps, no matter what background and community you come from, it's like, How much do you bend? How much do you compromise?
Smriti says she looks forward to the day when Indian culture is more mainstream globally, and a lighthearted Indian matchmaking show won't be expected to address every issue, like colorism and caste. Still, she's trying to listen to all the show's critics and engage with them on social media to improve Indian matchmaking for a second season.
I embrace the responsibility. I want people to push me to do better, you know, and to represent us better.
As imperfect as Indian matchmaking is, Smriti says it shows there's a huge global audience for Indian-focused programming and paves the way for whatever comes next. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
The airspace over war-torn Syria, as you can imagine, is not safe. And yesterday we saw the potential for disaster. An Iranian passenger plane came into close contact with an American fighter jet. To avoid collision, the Iranian pilot banked hard and dropped altitude. It later safely landed in Beirut, but some passengers were injured. Iran and pro-Iranian media posted video taken, they say, by passengers. What exactly happened in the sky is unclear. Iranian media are reporting that the American fighter plane had been harassing the jet. U.S. Central Command says their plane had conducted a, quote, standard visual inspection. What is clear here, however, is that this incident could further strain tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Nagar Mortazavi is an Iranian-American analyst and host of the Iran podcast. Nagar, a civilian passenger jet having an encounter like this with a fighter jet. We heard the scare that put into the passengers. It does seem pretty unusual. What is your reaction to this news?
It does. And as you were saying, this is in the sky of Syria, although the Iranians are saying the passenger flight was on a frequent or their standard route going towards Lebanon. But we have to see this in the broader context of, first of all, the Syrian war and also U.S.-Iran tensions in the past year. But I think what's most important and we need to be sensitive about is that civilians on a passenger plane were injured and they could have been put even into more danger. So I don't think reading that statement from CENTCOM, it just seems like there isn't enough sensitivity to the danger that the civilians were put in.
So that's what happened in the skies over Syria. Can you tell us a little bit about the significance of the territory over where this took place, this area of southwestern Syria, Al-Tanf?
So this is part of the bigger anti-ISIS operation. And I don't want to get into an international law discussion of all of this, but the presence on the ground in Syria, depending on who you ask, by different forces, can be questionable. But what goes beyond that is not just the military presence, is the sort of harassing of civilians around the presence. Because what we hear from the commander from CENTCOM is that in order to protect their forces in the base, this plane, this fighter jet, was doing a routine or standard procedure of evaluating whether this is a civilian plane or not. And I think that is what makes it even more questionable or disturbing of how they just approach this passenger plane in order to protect a military presence on a war-torn region.
So the big picture here is relations between the U.S. and Iran are at a low point, and this is just the latest in a string of incidents that have inflamed tensions. What could this episode do to exacerbate things further?
We've seen in the past year, despite an increase in the military tension of all the incidents in the Persian Gulf, the killing of the Iranian general, and then the Iranian retaliation on the Iraqi base on U.S. forces and all of that, we see that both sides are trying to just keep it a step before an actual conventional war. It seems like neither the Trump administration or the Iranian regime don't want to get into a full-on war with the other side. But then at the same time, despite their reluctance, things can get out of hand very quickly. It's a volatile region and, you know, it can have a domino effect and quickly escalate into something that maybe neither of the two sides eventually wanted. But then with a proxy spread in the region and all of these allies and foes of each side, it's just a very dangerous situation that the two sides have put each other in. And I want to point out that all of this tension was escalated basically when President Trump decided to pull out of the Iran deal, cut diplomatic communications with Iran, and then just go towards this path of escalation and tension and no openings or diplomatic channels.
Negar Mortazavi is an Iranian-American analyst and host of the Iran podcast. Good to speak with you, Negar. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
A momentous day for Muslims in Turkey today. For the first time in 86 years, Friday prayers were held inside the Hagia Sophia, a gorgeous dome structure and UNESCO site in Istanbul. Politicians in suits, ties, and surgical masks kneeling in front. Istanbul's most famous landmark has been a museum since 1934. Last week, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan ordered the 1,500-year-old building to be converted back into a mosque. Not everyone is happy about that, notably Orthodox Christians in Turkey. Elizabeth Prodromou is the director of Tufts University's Initiative on Religion, Law, and Diplomacy. Elizabeth, how is this moment being felt in the religious world?
I think this is a moment by any believer of any faith tradition. It's a moment of great sadness because the circumstances and the causes for the reversion of the UNESCO World Heritage Site to a mosque, I think, are ones that all people of faith who prioritize freedom of conscience, belief, and religion understand are very problematic.
So what concerns do Orthodox Christians have, and are they the only religious minority concerned about this?
For Orthodox Christians in particular, the Greek Orthodox community in Turkey, which is really only about 1,500 to 2,000 people, they are very concerned because it's a direct message to them that they continue to be subject to the arbitrary whims of the Turkish state. But that message, I think, is, you know, felt more broadly, certainly by Armenian Orthodox Christians, by Jews in Turkey, by Syriac Orthodox Christians in Turkey, by Alawites, who the Turkish state considers to be non-conforming Muslims. So this is a message about religious dominance and hegemony. And President Erdogan of Turkey has been very straightforward about this. He's spoken about this as a conquest and a reconquest. And I think that's the concern for vulnerable communities, but also for members of the majority Sunni community who would not have supported this move.
So understandably, critics of President Erdogan say this is a political move. What are his motivations with this conquest, as he calls it?
Well, many people point to, and I think rightly so, the fact that there's a paradox at work here. It appears that this is a moment of great strength for Erdogan, but in fact, it speaks to his declining domestic support due to the country's economic freefall over the last several years. And now that mapped onto the economic problems created by the COVID-19 pandemic. But beyond that, I think the real motivations are that, and we've seen this since Erdogan was elected in 2002, November, his view has been to recreate Turkey as a new Ottoman Empire. And that means domestically to make all the sorts of legislative and social changes that he has done successively regarding what he considers to be acceptable Islamic practice. And then also in terms of reconquest, he's talked about Sarajevo to Baghdad, Andalusia to Bukhara. So we're talking Spain to Uzbekistan, Bosnia to Iraq. You know, this is a message to people outside of Turkey that the reconquest of Turkey's Hagia Sophia Museum Mosque is the first step to reconquering what he sees as lost territory that once belonged to the Ottoman Empire.
Are some of his critics also, do you imagine, Muslim? I mean, some Muslims must see through this and the political capital Erdogan's trying to build by doing this. Are they resentful that he's playing the religion card?
Absolutely. I mean, inside Turkey, I mean, we know from any empirical measure that one wants to use that the country has moved, you know, quite rapidly over the last 18 years in the direction of a dictatorship, at least an authoritarian regime, if we want to use that kind of language, but a dictatorship. That's meant that Turkey, for example, has more journalists in prison than any other country in the world, including China. It's meant, you know, a dramatic limitation on free speech, free press, freedom of assembly, all the things that one associates with a healthy democracy. And so all Turkish citizens have been subjected to that if they're seen as quote unquote enemies of the state. So this is just, you know, one more step, this kind of arbitrary decision. And there are also fears amongst Turkish citizens, Muslims and non-Muslims alike, this is the deliberate instrumentalization of religion. And that goes back to then the geopolitical implications of this decision. And the decision to do it today, by the way, on the 24th of July, which is the anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Lausanne, which established the boundaries of the Turkish state and which included protection for the country's religious minorities. And President Erdogan has stated publicly that he would like to abrogate the Treaty of Lausanne and redraw the borders of Turkey.
Multi-layered in its symbolism. Would you say, Elizabeth, that Turks and democracy in Turkey were better served when the Hagia Sophia was a museum?
Yes, I would. I think it would be great if the structure could be used with its original intention as a museum and a World Heritage Site. It becomes a space then for people of all traditions and also for people who have no faith tradition to appreciate the magnificence of a site that was treated as a sacred space, but which is now an architectural, an aesthetic, and a historical gift to the world.
Elizabeth Prodromou, Director of Tufts University's Initiative on Religion, Law, and Diplomacy. Thank you very much for being with us today to talk about this.
Thank you, Marco.
The evolution of dolls in this country. Going backwards in time, you got your Groovy Girls, then American Girl, Cabbage Patch Kids, and then all the way back to the 1950s.
Barbie's small and so petite. Her clothes and figure look so neat.
Modern-day dolls are no longer confined to the rigid looks of Barbie 70 years ago. Today, dolls reflect different races, gender expressions, and professions. The inclusivity in the doll world is only growing wider. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
2 years ago, when a little girl named Lulabelle was born at a hospital near London, doctors knew something was wrong. Here's her mom, Sam Butler.
So my daughter was born with heart problems, so she had open heart surgery at 14 weeks old.
That open heart surgery left little Lulabelle with a scar down her chest. Her mom, Sam, said her daughter, now a toddler, had a checkup at the doctor's office in January.
And she found it so hard and was crying and was really uncomfortable. And it was after that I was like, I need to find her something that she can take with her next time.
Next time, Sam thought, maybe Lulabelle could take a doll that also had a scar on its chest, so she'd feel less alone and less different. But finding such a doll wasn't easy. Until Sam found out about Victoria Band.
I want to make something that will make a difference.
Victoria is a UK mom behind the doll business called Special Friends. She hand-makes dolls who have scars, cleft lips, oxygen tanks, or anything else that matches what a child has.
My eldest son is actually deaf in both ears. And he even said, you know, if there was something like that when he was younger, when he was getting his hearing aids, it would have probably, like, helped massively.
Victoria's handmade dolls have since helped hundreds of kids, like Jamie, a little girl who received her own doll this spring. Her mom, Cheryl, captured the moment on video.
Who's that?
The doll.
Is that your baby?
Yeah.
And what has she got, Jamie?
Jamie points out the scar and glasses the doll has, same as her own. And?
A hearing aid!
You got a hearing aid? Is that just like you?
Yeah.
Is that good?
Yeah.
Do you like her?
Yeah. I like her a lot, and I will take care of her.
The same scene played out in Sam Butler's home when her daughter, Lulabelle, got her own doll in the mail.
She got it and she was like, Mommy, scar, 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 me, scar, me, scar. So she pulled up her top and she was matching scars with her baby. And it was nice that she had something that could relate to her.
Special Friends has been up and running for less than a year. But Victoria has already sent dolls beyond the UK to Germany, the US, and Australia. She says seeing the reactions come in from around the world is priceless.
You know, you can't ask for much more than to see a child really happy. That's worth more than anything.
Victoria says the dolls can also be used as an educational tool to teach kids about medical equipment, surgeries, and conditions they may not know about, so no child feels alone or different in the first place. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
So Major League Baseball got underway last night to empty stadiums. The evil empire, 205 miles to the south of us here in Boston, they chalked up the season's first victory. You know who I'm talking about.
Stanton with a drive out to left center field. And just like that, the Yankees have jumped in front. 2-0 New York. Had there been fans in the ballpark, it was a guy that bought the worst seat that would have gotten that souvenir.
Yeah, still, it was great to have a little normalcy. For Canada's only team, though, the start of the season is looking anything but normal. The Blue Jays are not even welcome in their own country. Here's The World's Stephen Davey.
Canada has flattened their coronavirus curve. The U.S., not so much. On top of that, the U.S.-Canadian border is closed because of the pandemic. so they couldn't have players going back and forth across the border. Marco Mendocino, a member of Canada's parliament, spoke to the CBC. He said they tried to work out a solution with Major League Baseball, the Blue Jays, and various levels of government in Ottawa, but
the advice that we got was that there were serious risks that remained, and therefore we concluded that there was not a principal basis on which to issue a national interest exemption.
Ice hockey got that national interest exemption, because Canada. So strike one against the Blue Jays. Baseball fans are bummed not to have the action up at the Rogers Centre in Toronto, but this fan seems to see the bigger picture.
We all have to do our part and respect everyone's social distancing. And again, we will appreciate the game more when it does come around.
But it's not like fans in Toronto or anywhere can actually go to the stadium anyway. Still, it would be nice to have a place to call home. Any place. The Blue Jays tried to find a new home in Pittsburgh to share the Pirates' home, PNC Park. But earlier this week, Pennsylvania said, not so fast. Here's Pennsylvania's Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine.
We took the action in terms of Toronto Blue Jays because it's just more people coming to particularly Pittsburgh and Allegheny County where we've had increases, and we did not want to take that risk.
Strike two. So where to turn to next? The season begins for the Blue Jays tonight against the Rays in St. Petersburg, Florida. Blue Jays officials engaged in talks with the state of Maryland about sharing the Baltimore Orioles stadium. Or there's also Toronto's spring training facility in Florida. But the COVID spike there is not looking good. And also, who wants to play baseball in summer in Florida? The Blue Jays also have a AAA affiliate in Buffalo, New York. That prospect has been creating some buzz on local news.
People here in Buffalo tell me they are crossing their fingers, hoping they choose this stadium.
But the big league players are used to nicer amenities than are found at a minor league park. But with the clock ticking, this afternoon, just days away from hosting their first home game, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo made the announcement. The Toronto Blue Jays will be the Buffalo Blue Jays this year. Or rather, the Toronto Blue Jays of Buffalo. It kind of has a nice ring to it. For the world, I'm Stephen Davey.
Cuban-American Arturo Sandoval on the horn taking us out today, even though we're well past the seventh inning. We're always in play, though, at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, stay healthy, and enjoy some ball games this weekend.